This is Dan Austin. The date is Thursday, February the 20th, 1992. I'm at the home of Lee McPhail in Delray Beach, Florida. This is an interview with Mr. McPhail and his rich experience in the management of baseball from right after World War II up until, I guess, the mid-1980s. And this recording is for the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, New York. Lee, thank you very much for agreeing to this interview. And we talked briefly before we started this taping. And I found out that, indeed, we had something in common, as I was a member of the Knothole Gang in Kansas City when you were the general manager. And I guess that was when you really first started as, well, I guess you really started in Reading, Pennsylvania, did you not? Yes. In the Interstate League?
That's correct, 1941. Then.
41.
I was a business manager at Reading, which was a Dodger farm team.
Okay, and your dad was then head of the Dodgers in Brooklyn at the time.
That's correct.
Okay.
We had Fresco Thompson was our manager. Carl Perillo was our right fielder.
Oh, really?
And Al Campanis was our second baseman.
Al Campanis, yeah. I didn't know he played the professional baseball.
Oh, yes, yeah, right out of NYU, and then played with us, and then went to Montreal and played in one of the majors.
Okay. Before you went into as the businessman, or was a business manager?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have a lot of questions because I could never understand who did what in baseball hierarchy, from the general manager to the director of player personnel, on and on and on. But we'll get to that in just a moment. You're a graduate of Swarthmore College in outside of Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
What year?
1939.
And how did you? I taught at Temple University in Philadelphia, so
yeah,
I've been to Swarthmore a couple of occasions. A very fine school. And. And was this a school that you selected, or is it something that you lived in the area that you heard about, that you went to Swarthmore?
No, as a matter of fact, we were living in Ohio at the time, but I wanted to go to a small coeducational liberal arts college.
Uh-huh.
And I'd looked at several when my father asked me to go look at Swarthmore. My father had a long love-hate relationship with Branch Rickey, whom he worked for when my father was at Columbus. And Branch's daughter, Alice, was going to Swarthmore. And so I went out and looked, and I took one look at it, and that was enough for me.
Fell in love with it.
It was a great school.
Yes, it is. Beautiful campus, a rich history of excellence in higher education.
Yes.
So your dad was in Brooklyn, this love-hate relationship. Maybe you want to describe that with Branch Rickey. Because your dad was indeed a pioneer introducing night baseball in Cincinnati.
Yes, my father got into baseball in Columbus. It was around the time of the Depression. And just before the Depression, he'd taken everything he had, everything my mother had, and he built a medical arts building up near Ohio State University. Then the Depression came, and that was wiped out. Because of the Depression, the Columbus Senators were about to go bankrupt. They were owned by the man who owned the Cincinnati Reds at the time.
Oh.
And he wasn't going to be able to operate them. So a bunch of businessmen there, feeling that this was not the time to lose their baseball team when the morale was brought down in the city, went together and got up enough money to run the team. And they knew my father, he was an old friend of theirs, so they got him to operate the team. And, of course, the first thing he did, these people didn't want to bankroll a minor league team for long. He went around calling on different major league teams, trying to take one of them to take it. And the Cardinals took it, and Branch Rickey was the general manager of the Cardinals then. So that started their relationship. Which, after a few stormy sessions and a few years, and a new ballpark being built in Columbus, but anyway, he finally had a couple run-ins with Rickey and the Cardinals, and they let him go. And then he went from there to Cincinnati. But that was the start of the Rickey-Larry McPhail relationship.
And then when in Cincinnati, there was a club that I guess was owned by a bank. They weren't interested in staying in the baseball business.
That's correct.
And so Philip that got involved in refrigerators and cars?
Crosley, yeah. Again, it was pretty much the same thing. The bank in Cincinnati, they knew my father's record in Columbus, so they got him to come down. And again, they were looking for someone to capitalize the team, and they got Mr. Crosley to buy the team. My father stayed there for 3 years. The team was improving each year.
Mm-hmm. Kind of down in the dumps like the old St. Louis Browns when he came on board, and then he really built them up to the sense that, 1939 and 40, they won back-to-back pennants.
Which team are you talking about now?
The Reds.
Oh, yeah, the Reds.
I mean, he built them up to the point, but then he left they won the pennants, but he took a team and turned it around, even though he didn't stay around long enough to see them win the pennants.
Mm-hmm. They put lights in, of course, as you know. Franklin Delano Roosevelt threw the switch for the first night game.
What was it in your dad that, he didn't grow up in a baseball family. I don't know if he was around baseball.
He played a lot of baseball, sandlot baseball up in Michigan. He grew up in Michigan. He played baseball all the time.
But did he just have a lot of business savvy of how to organize people? And
well, after he got out of college, he got his law degree. He was a lawyer, and he was involved in business operation of his law firm, a Chicago law firm, sent him to Nashville, Tennessee, to take over a department store that was on the rocks that they were representing. And it was while he was working in Nashville when World War I came, and he left them to go into the service. And I'm sure you know the story about him after World War I was over, when he, along with Luke Lee, who was his colonel, my father was a captain then, and a couple of lieutenants, they tried to capture the Kaiser.
Kaiser, yes, I've heard about that. You want to elaborate on that for the record? I don't know how many people know about that in baseball history, that they tried to capture Kaiser Wilhelm.
That's correct. He had left Germany and went to Holland. Because the feeling then about the Kaiser was almost the way it was about Hitler after World War II. They felt that he was, and maybe unfairly so, that he was a war criminal and should stand trial. So that's what led them to hatch this plot of...
Was this an escapade of their own?
Yes.
It didn't have the sanctions of anybody...
Absolutely not. When they got back, they almost got court-martialed. But anyway, they got into the castle in Holland, where the Kaiser was staying, but the count, the Dutch count he was staying with, smelled a rat, and he called the Dutch troops. And when the Dutch troops came, Dad and his party beat a hasty retreat. As he went out, he grabbed an ashtray, which was a memento of the Kaiser's ashtray. I have that in our apartment in New York right now.
Well, I hope this stays in the family for many decades.
That he, as I say, he almost got court-martialed, but General Pershing said, well, what those boys did was wrong. He said that I would have given a month's pay to have been with them.
Well, with that kind of blessing, you kind of got off the hook in a hurry then.
Right. You can get back to myself and Redding and the branch Ricky Larry to fail love hate relationship. In those days, if you operated a minor league team when the season was over, you went back to Brooklyn and worked in the Brooklyn office. One day I got a call. It was branch Ricky calling me from St. Louis. He said, don't tell your father. He said, could you come out here to see me? And I said, well, Mr. Ricky, I couldn't do that without telling my father. But I'll tell him, and the story with him I'll come out. So I went out to see him, and he offered me the job running the Toronto Maple Leafs, AAA team. They'd finished last 3 years in a row, and they were having financial problems. And the major league teams that had teams in the league were trying to help them. Mr. Ricky was always, he was very smart about trying to find young people and put them in places where they might help him a little bit. I'll give you one little example of that. We had a pretty good team because every team in the league helped us with a player, let us buy a player at half price. And we got some pretty good players. We had a nucleus of a fine team, and we were battling to get into the playoffs. And it's toward the end of the season, and I got a call again from Mr. Ricky. He said, Lee, my people tell me, they had a team in Rochester, My people tell me that all you need to get in the playoffs is a little more hitting. He said, we've got Jimmy Ripple playing first base over at Rochester. We've got a young first baseman we could send up there, so we can let you have Ripple. I said, gee, Mr. Rickey, that's wonderful. He said, well, you know, we have to make some kind of a trade. He said, why don't you send us a pitcher? And I said, well, who would you like? And he said, well, I don't know who's on your staff. He said, who do you have? And I named about three or four pitchers. And he said, oh, Bill Beckman. Yeah, I remember Bill Beckman. He said, that's okay. Send him over. So that was the trade. And Ripple for Beckman. Now, a couple of weeks later, the Dodgers and the Cardinals are fighting for the National League pennant. I'm with Toronto. We're playing in Newark. We got rained out. So I went over to Brooklyn where the Dodgers and the Cardinals are playing this crucial series. And along about the seventh inning, when things are heating up, the Dodgers have a rally going, the Cardinals have someone warming up. And they think, who's that warming up then? 37. They're the Bill Beckman. No, I knew I'd been had.
You knew.
Well, he's a shrewd trader. He's a shrewd judge of surrounding himself with quality people to get the kind of team he wanted.
He was a good baseball operator.
What'd you do during the war?
I left Toronto to go into the service. I was going into the B-7 program.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me, fine, I was accepted, but their next class didn't start until December. So I quit my job. Until December came, I worked at Saks Fifth Avenue, you know, in the Christmas rush, they hired people. And then, right before the time that I was supposed to go in, they called me up and said, you have to come down and retake your physical exam. They think there's a little murmur or something in your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down, and I couldn't pass the physical. So by then, you couldn't enlist anymore. It was all done through the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what I was going to do. And I had a friend who was teaching at the Deerfield Academy. And he said, look, I need teachers. Now, with everybody going to service, come up and talk to Mr. Boyden, the headmaster, and maybe you can get a job here. So that's what I did. And I went up there and taught for about a year and a half and finally passed my exam, physical exam, and got a commission in the Navy and spent the rest of it on a destroyer.
And your dad was back in Brooklyn.
Well, he left the Dodgers to go back in the service. So he
went back into the service then.
Right?
After the war, of course, that's when your dad went over to the Yankees.
Yeah. Okay, I'll tell you a story about that.
Okay.
The Rupert estate was going to sell the team. Colonel Rupert had died, so the club was for sale. So my father had a backer who was going to put up the money. So he was talking to the lawyers for the Rupert estate. And the bank, that was my father's backer's bank, told the lawyers for the Rupert estate that anything Larry McPhail wanted to do, they'd stand behind financially. So that was all set. So they had everything just about set. The papers were all ready to be signed. He was supposed to go down to the law offices the next day to sign the papers. He got a call from Judge Landis. He said, Larry, I know this man that you have backing you trying to buy the Yankees. He said, he's in horse racing. He said, there's no way that I'm going to approve that. And my father didn't know what to do. So being him, he went down, didn't tell the lawyers anything about it, signed all the papers. Now he's got the club for $3 million.
Bought the Yankees for $3
million? Yeah, but he has no money.
No money.
So he went to 21 Club. Went to the bar, was having a drink, deciding what to do. And in came Dan Topping, still in his Marine uniform. And Dan knew Topping because Topping had the Brooklyn Dodger football team. And they played in Ebbets Field, and they had gotten to be playing. So Dan talked to Topping about it, and Topping was interested, and Topping got webbed in, and so they bought the club.
Bought the club for $3 million,
right.
And Judge Landis...
Well, he didn't have any horse.
Didn't have any horse trainers or horse bettors.
They not only got the Yankees, they got Yankee Stadium, they got Newark, and the Newark Stadium, and Kansas City, and the Kansas City Stadium. All this for
all for
$3 million.
What a deal!
Yeah, it was a great deal.
Of incredible. Could you repaint Yankee Stadium for $3 million nowadays? Your dad had a rough year that first year in 1946 with the Yankees. He fired three managers, Johnny Noone, Joe McCarthy, and Bill Dickey.
Yeah, well, Bill just finished up. So did John, really. I mean, McCarthy was a manager.
He was the one that started out. And
the others just sort of filled in.
So that partnership with Dan Topping and Del Webb really didn't last too long.
Well, that was 45.
Uh-huh.
46, see, all their players were in the service. They're good.
That's
players.
Right, they all came back.
And they, when the players started coming mm-hmm. back, yeah. they were doing better. And then, as you know, they won the pennant in 47.
And you went down to be the GM for Kansas City Blues.
That's correct, as soon as I got out of the service.
As soon as you got out of the service. And we were sharing some thoughts about that just prior to turning the tape on. If you could, well, we're talking about Carl DeRosa's perfect game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was when the sore arm right-hand pitcher, Billy Meyer, says one more time at it.
Yeah.
And Babe Barna was up there at the bat. And I always heard that really that ball was high and inside, but the umpire said, I'm going to give Carl DeRosa the benefit of the doubt.
I know that's what they say with Larson's.
That's right. Pitch. Dale Mitchell, you know, who didn't strike out much.
Yeah, but that was a great thrill. I think they're the only two perfect games I've seen, Carl DeRosa's and Don Larson's.
Kansas City was a good baseball town.
A great baseball city, right.
What do you remember about the fans? Were they knowledgeable or just Midwestern politeness?
No, they were knowledgeable baseball fans. I mean, they could get a little upset if things didn't go right.
If some outfielder consistently threw behind the runner or something like that.
Yeah. I told you the story about the Kansas City Monarchs.
Yes, please, would
stadium.
You?
And because the Kansas City Monarchs played in our stadium, they had promised us first chance at any good young players they had. And we had purchased Elston Howard and Frank Barnes from them while I was there. And unfortunately, Tom Baird, who owned the Monarchs, didn't think that we had given them quite as much money as they were really entitled to for these two players. It was pretty hard to get some money out of George Weiss to pay these for these players. So, but anyway, he told us that they had a young shortstop he'd like us to look at. So I sent Tom Greenway, who was our scout, who signed a lot of players mm-hmm. in that part of the country and scouted in the Negro Leagues, and look at him. But this boy was hurt at the time, and he didn't really get a chance to see him. And he said, I have to go back and see him the next opportunity I get. But I guess Tom felt that he met his word to mm-hmm. us, and he went ahead and sold him to the Chicago Cubs, and that boy was Ernie Banks. And I often think about what kind of lineup the Yankees of those days would have had if you'd added Ernie Banks to that batting order.
That's right. I guess you tell Ernie that story when you see him at the Hall of Fame every once in a while.
We both laugh about it.
Well, those are amazing, having a sore arm or the flu or something, and for one day, 24 hours, what a difference it makes in where one goes. Tell me, what does a general manager do, whether with the Kansas City Blues or with the New York Yankees? I always, I look at all these titles.
Yeah.
I have general manager, you have director of player personnel, you have a president.
You have to understand that the baseball business has changed tremendously from the time. When you're talking about when I was in the only operation we had was the players themselves. I mean, operating the team, opening the gates, selling tickets, booking the transportation. We traveled by train in the city.
You're kind of a traveling secretary as well.
Yeah, I either went on the road or somebody was working with me.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go on the road with the team. And there's the players were assigned there by New York. So for a general manager of a minor league team, that's about what it consisted of. General manager of a major league team in those days did practically everything. I mean, he was involved in the business operation of the team, the publicity, and the tickets, and the scheduling, and putting the team together. I mean, the general manager in those days did just about everything. I mean, you know, he had help, but
he
was the major domo, and he was responsible for everything. That's not true today.
Well, let's take, well, we see the changes in the job description, but let's take in the late 40s when then you went back up with the Yankees. Del Webb and company hired Casey Stengel as manager in 49, I think. Mm-hmm. And did a general manager negotiate all the trades?
Yes, George Weiss was the general manager. He negotiated the trades. He was responsible for signing the players to contract.
Well, did the manager have any say-so?
I mean, he would talk to the manager and get the manager's opinion on the players.
But I always heard that a ball team is patterned after the personality of a manager. I've never heard it patterned after the general manager or the president of a club.
It depends on the team and the manager and the general manager. I mean, there are situations where the general or the manager might have a great deal of influence in what's done. Mm-hmm. But really, the general manager is the boss.
He's the boss.
And the general manager in those days was definitely the one that had the final say on things.
He had his hands on the money.
Yeah, but, I mean, you wouldn't make a deal for a player your manager didn't like. I mean, if you needed a pitcher and you were going to trade somebody, first place you have your scouts and you go by your scouting reports. And you have your coaches and your manager there, and they would have meetings and talk about the different players that might be available, who to try to get, and so on and so forth. But today it's completely different.
It's quite different.
The job is more divided today between the business operation on one side and the baseball operation on the other side. And the person who's responsible for the baseball operation might be called a general manager. Mm-hmm. He might be called an executive vice president. Mm-hmm. He might be called anything.
Okay. But then it was, I figured as much it has changed dramatically from the job titles of yesteryear compared to 1992. Were you there when they honored Babe Ruth?
No, I was not.
You were not?
Yeah. My father was there.
Uh-huh. A point of question, Steve Suchok told me he was there that year, and it was a cold, kind of rainy day they were. But I didn't know if you were there, and if you had some particular memories of it.
Yeah, I think this could have been in 46, 46 or 47.
I think it was June of 48. He died in August of 48, just a couple of months later.
I was in Kansas City.
You were in Kansas City. Before we go to the Yankees and you're going up there, Kansas City always had a lot of promotions, almost preceding the days of Bill Vick. You know, you had Cats Night. You know, Cats Drugstore, and they used to give free tickets out, and you'd fill up that thing, 17, 18, 19,000 people.
We used to do...
Did you come up with those kinds of promos? And?
Well, I don't think I came up with that, but we would continue the ones we were going. One thing I did come up with, I think, was to have different community nights. I mean, we'd have a night for Lawrence, Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas night. We had the mayor and there and the sell a lot of tickets in Lawrence, Kansas. And we used to have the same old thing, the field events, you know, the races and stuff on the field.
But had that been with baseball quite a bit?
I think so.
So it wasn't nothing necessarily novel or new about it. It was something that good way to build PR and a good following of those small towns that surrounded Kansas City.
Correct.
You went up with the Yankees and were with them, what, from about 49 until 58?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
And saw some fantastic baseball and became part of some legends that hold very dear to us today.
Great years. Yeah, I was responsible for the scouting and the minor league teams. And we signed so many great players there, including Mickey Mantle,
Whitey Ford, Billy Martin. Mm-hmm. Were you aware of that tremendous array of talent as you were going through this day by day that you were assembling
We thought we had a good team and a good organization, but
well, that's an understatement. Yeah,
but you know, you had to struggle each year to win the pennant. I mean, there was always somebody, Cleveland or Chicago or somebody, Boston, really breathing down your neck. We were trying to stay ahead of your competitors.
It was rare that you would win more than by 2, 3, or 4 games, and yeah, go down to that final week.
Very close races, but the Yankees. You know, they were an outstanding reputation. They were an outstanding organization, and they had a great reputation. And they had a little edge often in signing a player, all things being equal. Mm-hmm. If the money was equal, often kids, particularly the Southern kids, would like to sign with the Yankees. But then when the amateur draft went in, mm-hmm. and I had something to do, I think, myself, with getting the amateur mm-hmm. draft in, that took away a great deal of the Yankees' advantage.
Yeah, took away that kind of trump card.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what, was really in that way, what you've just described has come full circle. Here he had the bonuses from $1 that Bob Feller got in 1936 to, I don't know what Mantle got, but it kind of, it escalated.
Okay.
Who could ever say, hey, I'll sign you up, here's the bonus I'll give you, and you had the edge. And then they say, hey, this can't go on because we're going to have the haves and the have-nots.
That's correct. That's why the amateur draft went in.
And the amateur draft
took their, turns, starting with the bottom teams
getting
first pick.
But now it's had to come that way full circle, except we have multiplied the bonuses by 500-fold.
The amateur draft is still in. But
yes.
If you draft a player, I mean, if he's a number one draft pick, it might cost you a lot of money to sign him.
That's right.
But for the most part, I mean, clubs, they bite the bullet on that. They can't afford to lose those high draft picks.
That's right.
And the Yankees last year signed a young pitcher by the name of Taylor, and mm-hmm. They had to give him a lot of money to sign a contract. He's just a high school pitcher.
That's right. Hasn't proven himself, have no idea what's going to happen.
But he's got a great arm.
Got a great arm. Well, I'd like to come back to that because it seems like what is happening now has come full circle in that to sign that, you got to pay $1 million, $1.5 million. I don't know what this year's draft pick will get, probably $2 million for a high school kid. That we're going to run into the haves versus the have-nots in terms of who are the clubs that can afford that kind of bonus?
I don't think the danger is so much in the signing of the amateur players as it is in the seasoned veteran players.
That's right.
You have the right to be a free agent.
That's right.
Free agent, or whether or not the salary arbitration, with the salaries having reached the point they have, whether the teams in the smaller marketing areas are going to be able to continue to pay this kind of cost of operation.
Especially when the TV contract is going to be renegotiated here in a couple of years.
Yeah. Well, the national television contract is divided evenly among all the 26 teams.
Mm-hmm.
But the big difference is the local.
That's right, the local revenue,
the Yankees have. The Yankees may get $50 million a year for their local television.
Which is kept by themselves.
Another team might get $2 million. So pretty hard for that team getting two and pretty good for one getting 50.
George Weiss. I heard his nickname was Lonesome George. he was GM of Yankees from 1932 to 1960.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard him described as a penny pincher, a czar, a dictator. People, the ball players were afraid really to talk to him. And he didn't do much talking to anybody else.
Yeah, he didn't. He was uneasy talking to the players.
He would be tight-fisted. I remember Allie Reynolds told me that he just quit baseball in 1954. In many ways, at the height of it, because George Weiss wasn't going to get any money.
Allie had also been in a bus wreck or something where he had some back problems.
Oh, did he? Okay, I didn't hear that part.
George was an outstanding baseball person. I mean, he was a good organizer. He was very tough with salaries and costs. He worked to keep the costs down. He was an excellent general manager from the club's point of view, trying to mm-hmm. both put an outstanding team on the field, but also keep the costs down and make some money for the owners,
mm-hmm.
and as a result for himself.
Yeah.
No, he didn't get along well with the players. In fact, it sort of became my job. I was sort of the intermediary between George and the players. And I ended up signing most of the players.
Well, how did you go, signing after Mantle and Ford and Yogi Berra? Well, Berra had come there after the war. How'd you go about negotiating then? You know, they got fantastic records in the World Series, win the pennant year after year. Well, they won five straight there when you came up.
They were getting good raises in those days. What appeared to be good raises. But we'd talk about it. We'd have a budget, overall budget for the team about, you know, what salaries were going to cost. Mm-hmm. And I'd go over with George and he said, no, that's too much for him. And then it was my job. While I was there, I mostly did it by mail. That's the way most of the people negotiated in those days.
There were no agents in those days you had to go through?
And the player, of course, was at a great disadvantage. I mean, he either signed the contract or he didn't report for spring training.
That's right. Sign it or don't play.
That's right. It wasn't too good for the club either. They could not afford not to have a Mantle or somebody mm-hmm. playing for them. Mm-hmm. But I remember one year with Mickey, he'd been a Triple Crown winner the year before. And the following year, which I believe was 58, mm-hmm. 57, he'd had an outstanding year, but not as good as the Triple Crown year. So Weiss wanted to cut him. And he tried. I think he finally allowed me to offer him a small increase in salary. And I talked to Mickey a couple times. I said, Mickey, look, I've talked to George. I can't do any more for you. You're going to have to go see him yourself. Uh-huh. And which he did and didn't get anywhere. And I think finally Del Webb stepped in and got him signed.
Got him signed that way.
The other thing I did, George didn't like to talk to players when you had to send them out. So I would generally
send them out.
I mean, if you're sending them back to Kansas City
or New York
or somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I generally did that. Casey didn't like to talk to him either, but he didn't mind if we did it together. So Casey and I would talk to the players in those days when mm-hmm. we were sending them out. And I found that worked extremely well when I went to Baltimore and later when I went back to the Yankees as mm-hmm. general manager. I followed the same path.
That was your style of management,
to
face to face.
Going out face to face with the manager mm-hmm. there, so you couldn't have the general manager blaming the manager, mm-hmm. and you couldn't have the manager blaming the general manager.
That's right. The ball player leaves, or you leave, and they say, "Well, Lee McPhail said this." No, Casey said that.
That's right. That so it worked pretty well.
In those days, the claim was that the Yankees had their own farm team in the American League, namely the Kansas City A's.
Well, there was reason.
You think there was legitimate?
Yeah, there was reason for complaint about that on the club's part. I mean, what happened was Arnold Johnson was a close friend of Dan Toppin's, and he was in the concession business, and they sold him the Kansas City AAA team. Mm-hmm. As an expansion major league team, or replace Philadelphia.
That's right.
As a result, Arnold Johnson got the concessions in Yankee Stadium, and the Yankees Kansas City hired Park Carroll, who was the Newark general manager for the Yankees, uh-huh. to be their general manager. Uh-huh. They hired my brother as the publicity director.
So kind of interlocking directory.
Yeah, it was a very close relationship, and there were a lot of deals between the two teams. I'll give you one example. There were times when the Yankees could not sign a player because you'd have to sign him to a major league contract to get him, and they didn't have room on the major league list. Mm-hmm. So they would talk to the Kansas City club. Hey, we got great reports on this boy. You go ahead and sign him, and mm-hmm. maybe somewhere down the line we'll make a deal or something. Uh-huh. Cletus Boyer was...
Cletus Boyer was one of the fantastic third basemen.
So there were complaints by the other clubs, and the league finally stepped in and said no more deals between the Yankees and Kansas City.
And that's after they got Maris and sent down Don Larson and Hank Bauer, I guess.
Well, They had said no more deals before the Marist deal.
Oh, they did.
The Marist deal was sort of went against that. But,
who was the baseball commissioner then, Fort Frick?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't he step in? I mean, I can't imagine a Judge Landis permitting that going on at all.
Well, I don't want to make it sound worse than it was, because there was nothing that improper there, but there was the appearance of improper.
Almost sound like a sweetheart contract
deal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it wasn't right that there'd be that kind of close relationship between, particularly given the position that the two teams were in.
Yes, sir.
The Kansas City Club trying to build for the future and mm-hmm. would give up a star mm-hmm. that would help the Yankees today.
Excuse me.
You're
fired.
Okay.
In the years that you were with the Yankees were one of the last American League teams to sign a black ball player, and that's Elston Howard, if I remember correctly. Why do you, was it just so much talent that there was no room, or was there, you think, a residue of racism involved?
Well, they signed some players. When you say they were among the last to bring a player up to the major mm-hmm. league team, that's correct. But they signed some younger players. We had one run-in with Cleveland when we'd signed a player by the name of Louis Marquez
mm-hmm.
And another by the name of Artie Wilson. Mm-hmm. And Bill Beck found out about it and flew down to Puerto Rico, and he got Marquez to renege on his deal with the Yankees. And it all went to Chandler, and Chandler ruled. He ruled Wilson to belong to the Yankees and Marquez to Cleveland.
Mm-hmm.
That got the Yankees were mad, and Weiss and Webb were all mad. And
mm-hmm.
I think that was the start of when Chandler got eliminated as commissioner. But the Yankees had signed a boy by the name of Vic Power.
Yes,
he was a very fine player. And they had a couple other black players mm-hmm. who had possibilities. But they were convinced, I think this was the ownership of the team really, that they wanted an outstanding person to be the first black.
The Jackie Robinson type.
Yeah, and Elston Howard was definitely mm-hmm. that type.
Yeah.
And so I'd say we waited a little. Mm-hmm. The Yankees waited a little bit longer than they mm-hmm. normally would, but waiting for Elston to be ready to come up.
When he came up as
a manager. In the meantime, they traded Vic Power.
Mm-hmm. I remember when Vic Power played for the Kansas City Athletics there for a mm-hmm. short time.
That's
big
right.
man, big guy.
Yeah.
And boy, he could blast that ball.
I can remember when we first had him, I went to see an exhibition game. He was with Kansas City in AAA, I think. And we went to play an exhibition game in Augusta, Georgia, and they'd never had a black play there before. And they were all booing him, and he'd come up and bang went off the wall. Each time he came up, they booed a little less.
They got the hint.
Yeah,
they got the hint.
He was a great fielder.
That's right. He was muscular. I mean, he could trap that ball coming over to first base. I mean, he could dig it out of the dirt any number of times.
Yeah, he was a fine player.
Whatever happened to him?
He had a pretty good major league career.
I think he played with Cleveland, mm-hmm. if I remember correctly. And you left Yankees in 1958.
That's correct. 1958 was my last year, and one of my greatest thrills was the Yankee World Series win over Milwaukee.
Because they lost that series.
3-1.
And
it was the one that Bob Turley pitched.
That's right. Yeah, because I think that was the first time in World Series history that a team was down 3-1
second.
To come back and
win. It was second. I think somebody had done it before, well back in the past.
At the turn of the century,
It was the first time in modern times. Hank Bauer, we were talking about, was the hitting star.
What was the Yankees were down 3-1. They were going into Milwaukee to play the two final games, if mm-hmm. I remember correctly. Well, I mean, you never say pros never give up, but certainly it must have been a long, quiet trip from New York to Milwaukee.
It was a train trip.
A train trip, okay.
And the Yankees got in a lot of trouble when somebody, I think it was a trainer, was accused of saying that Milwaukee is a bush town. And that got out in all the Milwaukee papers, and they were indignant, and they were hanging Yankees in effigy all over the city.
Was there any, before that sixth game, you know, down 3-1, or fifth game, that kind of sparked somebody say something, or occurred that caused a catalyst?
No, it's just, you know, how close baseball games are.
Yeah. And,
just some ability came out. People had great years. The seventh game, Bill Scarron had a towering home run in the left field seats.
Yeah.
And Gil McDougall, I think.
But when you face the likes of a Lou Burdett.
Elston Howard made a great catch. Lou Burdett, that's a...
When you see Lou Burdett and Warren Spahn staring at you game after game, and...
Lou Burdett came up in the Yankees
that's
system.
Right. That's right. He played the Kansas City Blues in 40... Well, maybe when you were there.
No, it was later than that.
Oh, I see.
But I went to see the Kansas City Blues play in Charleston, West Virginia. And Lou Burdett called my hotel room and asked if he could come out and see me. And he came up and he said he was discouraged and things weren't going well for him and he wanted to quit. And I like to think that I talked him out of quitting. The following spring, the Yankees were training that year in Arizona. They traded places 1 year with the Giants. And the Yankees, Burdett was sick. And they put him in the trade with Milwaukee. And that year, in 1957, Burdett beat the Yankees three times in the World Series. So I wasn't so sure. I was glad I talked to him.
You talked about him enough. He was a fantastic competitor, like Bob Lemon.
Yeah,
he'd stare.
Great. I saw him in New York this winter at a dinner in New York.
And, you didn't dig in too much against Lou Burdett.
No. He's a good sinker.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good competitor.
You went over to Baltimore, and it was an expansion team, but it might as well have been, given that they didn't bring much with them to, from St. Louis. You went over in what capacity? GM?
General manager, and after a year, they made me president and general manager.
Why would you leave the team at the top? I mean, you know, everybody in baseball world would say, I want Lee McPhail's job, but you...
Well, I was assistant to the general manager in New York, and I was the general manager in Baltimore.
Okay.
That's a little different.
You thought your time had come.
Well, to tell you the truth, I was so enamored of the Yankees myself, I wasn't too happy about leaving. My wife didn't want to leave, and George Weiss didn't want me to leave.
Uh-huh.
But Dan Topping called me in one day, and he said, Lee, like he said, George is probably going to be here for a long time. He said, why don't you take this opportunity and go out and run a team on your own and see what you can do? So I took it as friendly advice. But before I went, see, Paul Richards had been both manager and general manager. He held both jobs. And Paul was a very definite character, and I wanted to make sure that Paul was really in accord with my coming and taking over as general manager.
Yeah, he was a very strong personality when it came to ideas on baseball and what kind of players were wearing his uniform.
He lived in Waxahachie, Texas, and I was in New York, so we met in Memphis halfway between.
I think you went more than halfway.
And he convinced me that he wanted me to come. So.
So he was able to relinquish the title of GM and say, Lee McPhail, you wear that title.
We got along fine. He'd already made a real good start about getting some good young players in the organization.
You had Harry Dalton with you.
Harry Dalton, and I'll go back a little with Harry. Harry was in the service out in Colorado, and my brother was the general manager of the Colorado Springs Sky Sox. And Harry walked in and his uniform one day and said, I just like to work for nothing when I have any leave. Uh-huh. So my brother said, fine, great. So that was Harry's start in baseball.
But he came from the old St. Louis Browns to Baltimore.
He was there when I was there, and had some good young people in the office.
So you kind of knew where closely. Was he director of player personnel or some comparable title under your direction?
He was farm director.
Farm director.
Mm-hmm.
And?
He at the time, he was assistant farm director, and Jim McLaughlin was the farm director. But Jim and Paul Richards didn't get along at all. And they, They had a situation there where the organization was split between two people, and we finally had to let Jim go. I think it was the only person I ever had to let go.
Well, what'd you do differently? Now, really, in many ways, Baltimore was an expansion team. I mean, not per se, but given that there couldn't have been too many quality players that went from St. Louis to Baltimore in 54 or 55. And yet, you went on a different track than what happened in Minnesota and in California with the Angels and the Kansas City A's that kind of floundered around for a long time. But you did something with the Baltimore team that was quite different.
As I say, Paul had started this and they'd signed some good young players, and we continued in the same vein. We were very fortunate in some of the young players we signed. And we just had outstanding young players coming along, the Boog Pals and the David Johnsons and the Brooks Robinsons. We made a couple of good deals. I think one of the better deals I made in my career was to get Louis Aparicio for the for the Orioles, and that just sort of cemented that, gave him a great left side of the infield. Brooks Robinson, Louis Aparicio.
That's right. Like vacuum cleaners down there.
And Boog Pal at first. And so they had a good solid team.
And that happened further quickly.
Well, I went there in 59, and they finally won the pennant in 66.
That's so right. So 6 years, but in some ways that's relatively short considering the Twins and the Angels and this is side two of tape number one, interview with Lee McPhail. So I think that blending of Lee McPhail and Paul Richards brought a different dimension in terms of signing young ball players and not just going after old veteran ball players that were being discarded by other teams.
Well, we had a lot of veteran players when I went there, but as our young players came along, we were able to replace them with the good young players. Mm-hmm. We lost Paul. In 61, he went to Houston.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that Paul Richards is known for his baseball smarts. In fact, I think when Hoyt Wilhelm was pitching, and his pitches were kind of unpredictable as to where they would go.
Yeah, knuckleball. they
finally made a rule because Paul Richards would take one of the infielders and put him behind the catcher, and you'd have two baseball players in foul territory.
I never saw that, but I know that they did pass a rule for that. But what Paul did do was he invented the big glove for the catcher, the oversized mitt, that enabled him to do a better job of catching the knuckleball pitcher. But when we traded Wilhelm, one reason we did was we felt it was going to be the end of our, Gus Triandis was our catcher. It was sending him to an early grave.
Toward the end of your being GM, Baltimore, which I think was about 1965, that was the year before Baltimore won the World Series.
Mm-hmm,
quite an upset against the Dodgers, if I remember. It was swept
up. I don't think anybody will ever equal their record in winning four games and allowing the least runs. I don't think they allowed over about four or five runs in that whole series.
You knew, did you help negotiate that trade for Frank Robinson?
Yes, I did.
What's the background of the story of getting an MVP out of Cincinnati for, Milt Pappas and Dick Simpson and one other player?
The Reds were looking for, they needed a starting pitcher and an outstanding, they wanted a good relief pitcher. And we just traded with Philadelphia for a relief pitcher. It was a top relief pitcher in the National League. And Pappas and the relief pitcher were really what made the deal. Then we had made a deal for Simpson that same year, and it just so happened that the Reds liked Simpson. So with him in the deal, that they were...
That seems incredible that...
They'd had a few little problems with
Frank.
I guess. And Bill DeWitt was the general manager. But I knew I was going by then. I knew I was leaving.
Mm-hmm.
So after we had the deal put together, I didn't say yes or no. I got Harry Dalton and Jerry Hofberger, the owner of the Orioles. I said, well, here's the deal, gentlemen. It's up to you to say yes or no.
Did they think about it? Or did they say, hey, I want to do it right away?
Him and Hawd around a little bit. Harry tried to get another player, and I think he did maybe get a minor league player or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he got somebody else in there that maybe arched your eyebrows a little bit. You brought Hank Bauer to Baltimore after...
Right, we hired Hank as a coach, and then eventually, after Paul had left, first we hired Billy Hitchcock as manager, and Hank was a coach under Billy. Billy Hitchcock was a great person, a fine man. Unfortunately, things just didn't go well for him in Baltimore for one reason or another as a manager. And so after 2 years, we had to let him go. And Hank took over and did a great job.
Yeah, manager of the year in 66. And you think of someone with the personality of a Hank Bauer. You know, he would... every play for Hank Bauer, I always kind of thought of Hank Bauer and Enos Slaughter in the same mold.
A little bit same, right?
Aggressive, you know, every play is can decide whether or not you're in the World Series, whether it starts on April 15th or it's on September 15th. That great, same kind of intensity.
Yeah, great competitors.
Great. I think a manager like that can survive in with today's ball players. That kind of intensity and aggressiveness?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think that because someone is intense and aggressive means that he can't handle men. And, I don't know whether Hank was the best handler of men or not, but he certainly did an excellent job for Kansas City.
That's right.
In 66.
Yeah. Now you're on your way to going up. We have a new commissioner of baseball.
Yeah.
And someone who probably knew about as little about the game since Judge Landis.
That is probably true.
The general, and you were really, I guess, to go up in the commissioner's office to really be the man behind the throne.
Well...
those are my words, not anybody else's.
Yeah, right. Well, they wanted a baseball person in there with Commissioner because they recognized that he didn't have the background in baseball. And Jerry Hofberger just bought the Baltimore team from Joe Eagleheart and Zan Krieger. And I sort of felt that a new owner coming in ought to have the opportunity to pick his own people there to work for him. Although Jerry really wanted me to stay. Said. But then when some of the owners of the clubs came to me and said that they really needed me to do this, I after all what baseball done for our family, I felt like I needed to try to repay a little bit. But I did say when I went that I didn't want to stay too long.
Okay. Well, you stayed for three years?
No, one.
Oh, you only stayed 1 year?
Yeah, all right. I went back to the Yankees.
Oh, that's right.
You
went back in the Yankees. Being GM and really calling a lot of the shots to being an assistant administrator to help out the general, Spike Eckert, it must have been incredibly difficult to almost look at case by case, situation by situation, telephone call by telephone call as to what prerogatives you had to act on behalf of organized baseball.
Well, mostly, I mean, he acted, but we would talk about it.
I know that.
What problems he had. In fact, he'd like me to sit in his office often as he got phone calls, and I'd hear him, and we'd talk about him later. So at least we did that at the start. I don't think that had to go on too long that way. But he was a nice man who was very easy to get along with, and we had a good relationship.
But he was, here we get the first inklings of baseball strikes. And a little bit later we get Curt Flood. That went on up, that case went to the Supreme Court.
What had happened with the players, the player representatives on the team were often the older players, and so they would be moving away. You know, they weren't generally regulars and stuff. So there was quite a turnover. They had someone part-time, Judge Cameron in Milwaukee, handling their affairs, and they wanted a more permanent organization for the Players Association. So some of the players Bob Friend was the leader, went to John Galbraith, the owner of the Pirates, who was head of our pension committee at the time, and asked if baseball clubs wouldn't help them make a more permanent organization. And we talked about it with the pension committee members and the executive council and with Eckert, and we thought that their request was reasonable. And they were going to hire Cannon to be the mayor. So everything was going along on that basis, and then there was a problem between Cannon and the players. One, he didn't want to move his office out of Milwaukee. They wanted him in a two-club city. And the other was that he wanted the same kind of pension he would get as a judge or something. I think those were the big problems. Mm-hmm. So the next thing you knew, Cannon was sort of out. And Robin Roberts, someone called Robin Roberts, is Professor Taylor from the University of Pennsylvania, and recommended Marvin Miller. And Robin says to this day that he told Eckert that if the clubs had any objection to Miller, that they would back, the players would back away from it. I never heard that, but if Robin says it, I'm sure it's true. But I don't know who Spike mentioned that to. In any event, the players had their meeting and they elected Miller. And by now, a lot of the clubs are hearing bad things about Miller.
Yeah, he came out of the old steel workers union. You know, he's got a lot of blood on the on the hillsides in that union.
Yeah, right. So some of the clubs were trying to get the players not to vote to accept him, but he was voted in.
And he stayed with them from
up until
about 82, 83?
That's correct.
Then Don Fearer, I guess, who's
Don
now...
Don Fearer took over a little bit before that. Marvin retired about 81, 82.
Yeah.
But he's still involved in it.
Yes, I'm sure he is. I'm sure the phone calls come hot and heavy whenever, especially with some contracts that are going to be expiring here in the next couple of years. Bowie Kuhn came in as commissioner. Of course, you went back to the Yankees. You must have seen a different kind of Yankee organization.
Well, the Yankees had finished last the year I went back.
First time since World War One.
All their star players were older. You know, the Whitey Fords, the Mickey Mantles, and Maris was older and hurt. Yeah. And, the morale was sort of down, I guess. The worst problem was that their scouting staff had also gotten older. A lot of the key scouts who had done such great work for the Yankees, or the Paul Critchells and the Harry Hesses, and the scouts on the West Coast, Tom Greenway, those fellows were all older and were not quite as active and not as successful, Joe McDermott. So it was a case not only of building up the club, but before you could really build up the club, you had to rebuild the scouting staff.
So that was what you considered the first job to do?
Mm-hmm. So that's what we worked at. And we, Ralph Houck had gone from manager to general manager. Mm-hmm. When I came, he went back as manager.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph and I decided, mostly Ralph, because he'd lived through the last place finish, that it was time just to start just from the bottom and start trying to bring in young players and just start trying to build up. So we sort of cleared the decks of the older players who would be holding jobs. Some of it didn't work out too well. Maris had a couple of good years after we let him go.
Yeah. Went over to St. Louis, I believe.
Mm-hmm. No one would take him. The Cardinals were the only ones who finally would take him at the time.
And so you just really kind of cleaned house and started all over again.
We cleaned house and started over, and we started with just young players, so some of them before they were quite ready.
And you knew that was going to be about a 5-6 year process rebuilding.
Yeah, that's what I said when I came.
Oh, is it?
It would take probably a 5-year program.
If you want to hire me as a consultant, I'll be able to give you all this advice without any. Then you stayed until King George comes on board.
Yeah.
Now I use that for George Steinbrenner.
Yeah. Well, first I'd like to say a little bit about this. CBS owned the Yankees thing.
Yes, that's right. What, Mike Burke?
Mike Burke was the president. And everybody, the inclination is to blame them for everything and say they did a terrible job and they're bad owners. actually they were very good owners. They stayed out of the baseball operation, let us operate it. They didn't cut our budget as far as scouting or anything. And we were improving the team. We got up in 1970, I think it was. We finished second. We won 93 games. We had, by then, you know, we had the Thurman Munsons and the Roy Whites and the Bobby Mercers, and we had a lot of good young players. We were picked to win the pennant in 72, or our division in 73. That was the year that George bought the team.
And you and many others, Tal Smith and many others, all departed. Gabe Paul had left. Did you see the handwriting on the wall when Steinbrenner that came on board? That
well, we knew it was a different kind of operation.
Yeah, different personality.
We had the first example I had of it really well. One of them, personally, when George bought the team and he had a press conference, and he said that he was too busy in the shipping business to get involved in baseball, and that Mike Burke and Lee McPhail would be running the team. Within a month, he had fought with Mike Burke, and Mike Burke was gone. The first real problem I had with him, we were playing the exhibition games in Florida that spring. And we'd won six or seven games in a row, as I remember. And the Mets came to town, and we lost to the Mets. And it was on television. And George was so upset. He was mad that Ralph didn't have Stottlemyre or somebody all lined up to pitch against the Mets. All Ralph was trying to do was get his pitchers in shape for the start of the season. But George didn't want to lose to the Mets. But anyway, we got along fine when I worked for him while I was there. He didn't get involved too much. There were a few times, but not too much. The only problems I had with George came after I'd left the Yankees when I was league president.
It was
umpiring problems.
Yeah. And in 73, you became American League president there for a decade.
Right.
Until 83.
That's correct.
And if you look back, what would you say would be the highlights of your being the American League president that you would want baseball historians to say that Lee McPhail nurtured and guided and with others or singly, that in those 10 years, this is what I think were my greatest accomplishments out of the AL office?
Well, actually, for the American League, I guess probably the best thing I did was to get Toronto into the American League. The thought at the time was that Toronto should go to the National League with Montreal. But the National League, for a while, San Diego was supposed to move there, and that didn't work out. And then San Francisco was supposed to move there, and that didn't work out. And the people in Toronto were getting a little tired of waiting. And we told the National League we'd stand aside if they were going to move a team there. Mm-hmm. But 2 years later, they hadn't moved a team. And then we had, because of a lawsuit in Seattle, we had to expand.
We needed
one more team. And the obvious team was Toronto. I mean, it was by far the biggest metropolitan area and the best sports city, and so we wanted Toronto. The National League wasn't ready to take it, but the National League fought us on it, and the commissioner fought us on it.
And Boy Kuhn was the commissioner at that time.
But we eventually prevailed, and Toronto became part of the American League, so that's probably the best thing I ever did for
what about the...
I think as far as anything I've contributed to baseball, really, I like to think I've been involved in things like the amateur draft that we talked about before, the college rule, where we weren't taking players out of the college, the instructional leagues that now
they started in the early 70s.
The rookie leagues that don't start now in June when the players get out of high school and college. I was sort of involved in all of those things, along with Chep Feeney, who was president of the National League at the time.
What about the designated hitter rule?
I was involved in that. It wasn't my idea. I mean, actually, the idea was Connie Mack's.
What?
Connie Mack was the first one to propose the designated hitter.
But he had passed away by that time.
That's right. He proposed it way back in those days. It wasn't
really
acted upon. But it,
what, in the 1930s?
Yeah, what I'm saying, it wasn't a brilliant new idea that anybody came up with.
Oh, I thought it was.
No, it had been talked about, as I say, as long ago in the past as Connie Mack's day. But I think, personally, I'm a strong believer in the designated hitter. I think it makes a lot of sense. Adds to the excitement of the game, keeps a lot of good name players in the game for longer period.
And you just play offense and not defense. Does it take something out of the manager's...
That's what they always claim, but it, I actually think it's tougher for the American League manager than it is for the National League manager. The National League manager, if you're behind one run, you come up the seventh or eighth inning, you pinch hit.
You're going to pinch hit. That's right.
The American League manager comes up, and he may be a run ahead, but he's got to decide whether to leave that pitcher in there or not.
It's not going to be on the basis of who's coming up to bat in the next inning.
That's right. And as far as all this flip-flopping the lineup, my wife could do that, or my kids could do that. It's not that complicated.
Oh, it isn't?
No.
Okay. I grew up learning how to score baseball back in Kansas City when Larry Ray was a baseball announcer for the Kansas City Blues.
Sure.
And I met him one time, and he showed me how to keep score.
Mm-hmm.
When they never traveled with the team, they would broadcast out of a hotel room and have that.
I know
that
very
tape.
Well.
So the expansion into Toronto, of course, going to Seattle, had to because of that lawsuit. The designated hitter rule added excitement. But you also had some dealings with Charlie Finley, at least indirectly, although probably the baseball commissioner's office had to deal with him by vetoing some trades.
We had some very colorful people in the American League at that time. Bill Veeck, Charlie Finley, Gene Autry, Edward Bennett Williams, George Steinbrenner.
With all those big egos, how was anything accomplished?
Well, I tell you, when I took over as league president, the meetings were sort of bedlam, and I came up with a sand glass, and I said, everybody takes 3 minutes for the sand to run down. When the sand runs down, your time is over, your speech is done. You got out of there. But Charlie was never a problem to the American League. He was a big problem in the commissioner's office, but we didn't have any problem with
him. Okay. I understand that you set up, when you were in the league office, a scrutiny list of, that you had, namely a Mike Caldwell on spitballs. And you gave this out to the umpires that, to watch certain pitchers that they might be loading up the ball.
It's possible. I really don't remember.
Oh, you don't remember that?
But now that you mention it, it's possible. There were certain pitchers that other clubs would complain about.
Mm-hmm.
We probably just told the umpires to watch them.
Okay. Well, the story goes that you had a scrutiny list.
Yeah, that's the first time.
That you thought were pitchers doctoring the ball. One of them, Mike Caldwell, who was under that fantastic pitching coach, George Bamberger.
Mm-hmm, right.
And George knows a few tricks of the trade.
Yeah, right. George was an old Baltimorean.
Yes, right. He was pitching coach there when you were there, and you gave this to the umpires, but the umpires more or less kind of ignored it. They said, if I see a wad on it, I'll be the judge of that, and I'm not looking at any list in my hip pocket. Anyway, that's a story I had heard read about.
I don't know. We're just trying to enforce the rules.
During this time as AL president, of course, you worked closely, I'm sure, both you and your counterpart in the National League,